Hey everybody, Melissa McKenzie, publisher of the American Spectator here at The Spectacle with my co-host Scott McKay, the senior editor of the American Spectator and also publisher of The Hayride and Reviver.com. Welcome, Scott. Glad to
Hey,
have
Melissa.
you back. And
Yeah.
this is going to be an interesting episode. Why don't you tell us what we have to look forward to right now?
Well, we've got a guest today, a very distinguished and informative guest, I think. Mike Waller is the senior analyst for strategy at the Center for Security Policy in Washington. And we're here to talk to Mike about a book that he's written that I had recommended to me by a couple of people called Big Intel. This thing absolutely blew my mind when I read it a couple of weeks ago. It's Big Intel, How the CIA and FBI Went from Cold War Heroes to Deep State Villains. I mean, what a perfect, perfect title for a book. You can't really argue with that unless you're a Democrat. Mike, how are you doing today?
Doing great. Thanks. It's great to be with you.
So your book depressed me a great deal. It also informed me a great deal. It irritated the hell out of me. And I'm very grateful for having read it because you confirmed a lot of the suspicions that I had about both the FBI and the CIA. And your book is terrific in that it's a trip through history as to the founding of both the FBI and the CIA, and a very detailed kind of roadmap for how both of these two agencies went rogue and turned into really, yes, deep state villains, but corrupt to the core deep state villains at that. So obviously your background is you weren't a CIA agent, but you were an outside asset and worked for Director Casey. Why don't we get started talking about that a little, at least to the extent that you can tell us.
Sure. Well, the nice thing is I'm not bound by any, you know, pre-publication rules or anything else, so I can say what I want because I was not a CIA employee. This was a problem. Actually, today's big Intel problem. You could trace some of the origins to as far back as the first Reagan term when Bill Casey was CIA director, because he found that the CIA could not produce intelligence on Soviet linkages and support for international terrorism. And so many other things that journalists were finding, but the CIA somehow could not. So Casey commissioned outside people who had expertise to just go find it on their own. They came up with the information. He then challenged the CIA bureaucracy and they went kicking and screaming to not produce. Meaning he wasn't trying to get them to say what he wanted them to say. He said, find evidence and tell me what it means. And so finally they were able to do it, but they dragged their feet. So in part of this, Casey, having been in the Office of Strategic Services, the OSS during World War II, when they relied completely on amateurs, because we didn't have an intelligence service at the time, Casey went out and had people look for amateurs to do a lot of the work that the professionals within the CIA couldn't or wouldn't do. So that's how, that's how they found me. I was a college undergraduate, so I was just a nobody then and didn't have much experience. But they sort of cultivated me and brought me down to Central America to find, to hunt down and find Soviet support for communist insurgencies on our southern border.
This is, you know, back early 80s, I guess. And it's, this is, I mean, I don't even know how appropriate this is, but I was in a bar, a friend of mine who's my age owns a couple of years ago. And we were talking about classic 1980s movies, right? And of course, when you do that, and if you're a Gen X guy like me, Red Dawn, the original Red Dawn will come up. And so, you know, Pam and I are so, this movie, like when we were in high school, this was absolutely our thing. And of course, you know, there's the grad student, 22-year-old, right, who knows nothing. Oh, that's a stupid movie. Like, that was never, ever going to happen. Well, in 1984, okay, and you can attest to this, in 1984, when the opening credits of Red Dawn started rolling and it set the scene of, you know, the prelude to what that movie was going to be, that was actually a very real possibility in everyone's mind. Was, yeah, they're going to, the communists are going to take Central America. They will be at the Rio Grande, and the stage will be set for World War III with us at a supreme disadvantage, right? I mean, like that was a real thing. And you tell this to, you know, 20 somethings, they have no concept of it at all, like none.
Right. And it was made fun of then. Remember, they tried to keep it out of theaters and everything back then.
Yeah.
And part of the plot line was what? It was illegal aliens coming over the border who were militarized by enemy forces to come and attack us.
Yeah. Well,
one of the main antagonists was a Cuban general who came over that way.
Exactly. And you know, and actually the Cuban general ends up going soft, which, you know, it's an interesting movie in a bunch of different ways. But the thing that really kind of blows me away is the fact that it's such an iconic movie for our generation, which was really like the last Cold War generation, I guess you would say. We grew up in this, understanding that there was such a thing as an evil empire out there that needed to be defended against. How much of the intelligence community's mutation into what it is now do you think is a product of not really having that sort of focusing enemy that would, you know, create the mission diligence, I guess would be a way to put it, that it seems like the CIA lacks?
Yeah, even during the late, well, first the CIA was founded to wage the Cold War. Short of military means on the covert side, which was almost, you know, it was a let's do what the OSS did, but in peacetime, so we won't have to use military. But then the main purpose was to collect and analyze intelligence to inform the president about what's going on in the world so the president can make proper decisions. That began to collapse as the Cold War waned, because the CIA was never a conservative organization, despite what a lot of fiction is. It was mainly a sort of a covert State Department. So if you take a State Department mentality and you just classify everything secret, that's a caricature for what the CIA quickly became. So by the 80s, they really weren't interested in waging any Cold War. They went into it kicking and screaming. They couldn't detect certain Soviet strategic nuclear developments. They failed to predict the collapse of the Soviet Union. I was in Moscow at the time the Soviet Union was collapsing, in the Kremlin, the day Yeltsin and Ukraine and Belarus seceded from the USSR. We could see it coming way in advance, and the CIA was still saying that the Soviet Union could not collapse. So you can see how poor it was, all this groupthink, and they didn't dare to have even contrarian views to challenge this. It all had to be groupthink. This was worthless strategic assessments that made it impossible for any president to anticipate events and then to plan policy accordingly. Not that they necessarily would have, but at least they would have had the information. So by the time there was the end of the Cold War, the CIA, to get to your question, they didn't have an enemy anymore. And this is, in fact, what the Russians said: we're going to do something terrible to you Americans. We're going to deprive you of an enemy.
Under yeah. Order.
So when 9/11 hits, no one's prepared for this type of thing, even though there had been warnings in advance that there would be such a terrorist attack. CIA picked up some, FBI picked up some. They didn't get together to talk about it because there was a groupthink that this could never happen here.
Well, and now you have China, which fulfills pretty much all of the requirements of an enemy, I guess. What's your assessment of the CIA's performance with respect to China? Are we wide open where they're concerned, or do we have any functional intelligence capability vis-a-vis China at all?
Well, we know that we don't have a clandestine service like we used to have, where we could actively and aggressively and over long periods of time infiltrate enemy or adversarial organizations to any significant degree. And then we heard a few years ago, it was public, how the Chinese communists rounded up a lot of suspected CIA people who were in the system. So we really don't have much to act on there. But what we, even more important than that, I think, is the failure of the CIA analytical leadership to anticipate the rise of communist China as a strategic peer adversary. going back 1970s, 80s, 90s, 2000s, failure after failure after failure to anticipate the rise of the Chinese Communist Party as a strategic global nuclear threat in every single way, and the deep subversion of our own country. This is where the FBI has fallen completely flat on the right. counterintelligence side of things.
Yeah.
I have a question because you were operating outside of the infrastructure of the CIA and assisting it. And that has become, it seems like, their de facto operation now, to use non-government agents or to send actually their agents into, say, media companies going back and forth. It's like a continuous revolving door, it seems like, in and out of intelligence, if you're ever really out, or also using non-government organizations to do surveillance, to give them cover so that they don't have to abide by the United States laws, and can technically, I guess, be submit to the Constitution, but not in practical fact, don't. And so do we have a surveillance state now that is just entirely disconnected from any limiting principles within the government? Like, is there any part of the intelligence operation that isn't rogue in a way?
Well, you hit the word principles, Michelle, which is the real key here, because the whole purpose of our whole intelligence community and FBI is to protect the founding principles of our country in our Constitution. And so even when people make mistakes or break the law or do something that they otherwise shouldn't do, they're still grounded in our founding principles and we can right the ship again. We're losing that very rapidly now from in the whole intelligence community from top to bottom. So when you have a mentality that the American public, a large segment of the American public, represents a threat, and that it's not, you know, not jihadists or Islamic extremists. We can't say that anymore. We're not allowed to. The Office of the Director of National Intelligence, you know, has issued orders literally to that effect. But this went back all the way to the Robert Mueller days under George W. Bush. You can't say those words because they're offensive. So gradually we're losing the idea that we can name our real enemies. And gradually you have people who have been imbued in critical theory, you know, the Herbert Marcuse school of critical theory, to criticize all our institutions and our whole civilization, to tear it down. That we're a racist society. We were settled by racists. We were founded by racists. Our Constitution was built to enshrine racism in the very fiber of our, not just the legal system, but the economic and social systems and everything else. And so our founders have no redeeming values. You know, that pulls apart the principles that you just mentioned, and those principles uphold our law. So then you inject critical law theory, which comes from critical theory, which is cultural Marxism as deployed in the legal system, where critical law theory is to attack our Constitution, using our constitutional means of doing it to attack itself, to arrive at preconceived goals like diversity, equity, and inclusion. And when you put that as the mission of our intelligence services and our law enforcement, and you tie that in with the San Francisco values of big data, then you get that surveillance state.
So
you talk.
To bring it back around, but I didn't hear an answer in there. Do you think that our intelligence agencies are, in a sense, rogue? Do they have, and are they confined by any principles, or are they using these, you know, kind of loopholes of non-government organizations to achieve their ends against the American people? Because from what I can tell, the thing that's irritating to me is, okay, if you're going to surveil the American people and not have search warrants and not do anything but just use big data to monitor your own people, at least be able to prevent attacks. But the FBI and the CIA have been woefully inadequate on that account too.
Yeah.
And so, like, there's really, you know, what's the point of view is basically my question. And And what are we, what can be done? Because it sounds to me like they aren't, you say it's quickly failing. I don't see any evidence that it's succeeding at all. And so, like, you think it can get worse? I'm trying to understand here.
Well, a lot of questions in that one, but to answer your first question, do I think the intelligence community overall has gone rogue? Yes.
Okay.
And it's not a question of conservatives or MAGA people or anything else saying it. Let's just listen to what Chuck Schumer said in 2017 when he warned Trump. People interpret it as a threat against Trump, but he came out on MSNBC with Rachel Maddow and said flat out, if Trump goes after the intelligence community to bring it under control, they have 6 ways from Sunday to go after you. So he's saying that as the senior Democrat in the United States Senate, right after Obama's administration, right as Trump is coming in, and he's effectively arguing neither the president nor the Congress can challenge this entrenched intelligence community.
Well, that's not very comforting at all, but that's pretty much what I thought the answer would be. So if there's no way to challenge this group of people, what chance does the American citizen have of living an actual free life?
If it's not challenged, we don't have much of a chance. But also, we surrender our own information every time we use a Google product, every time we use a Microsoft product, every time we use shop on Amazon or any place else. Every time we use an app of any kind, almost, we're surrendering our personal data and our privacy, and we're allowing the surveillance state to use it. So and I've seen it when I was working with the military during the global war on terror. I can't even come up with a good name for that. But I saw firsthand how this technology is used to track people on apps for psychological operations purposes. Mm. That's where I was involved. But you could also use it to track people to kill them real time. Mm-hmm. And there's no trace. You can track their exact movements everywhere. So, and then you can anticipate what they will do to develop patterns. So you can develop psychological profiles of people. And right. You know their whole network. So meaning this, to have this, when we click, I agree on all these, user agreements that we never read or understand, we're agreeing basically to allow these companies to merge with not just our security apparatus, but with the Chinese or the Russians or anybody else.
I remember when Twitter first started and the API was open and you could see, there was an app, like you could see everybody had their location services on. They didn't know, because back then, it was just, people didn't understand that that was something that was a problem. And I remember watching people who I was following, because I figured out that you could do that. And you could like literally see them driving in their car. And then they were turning here while they were, on the app. And people just didn't understand the power of the technology. And even still, I don't think it's such a passive thing. I don't think people can fully comprehend the extent. And then this, the question becomes for an American citizen to opt out of that would really be to find create a Faraday bag and throw all your equipment in there. And then what, walk around with a wad of cash, because that's the only solution to, if you'll even it'll even be accepted, and you get in your vehicle and that's being tracked, and that's goes back to the 70s, maybe not in real time, but like even with like the black boxes, that goes back to way longer than people realize.
Sure.
And GM was the first one that,
and the tolls that we go through, and mm-hmm. the Easy Pass or whatever parking apps we use. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And they don't want us using cash anymore, do they?
No.
It's almost a crime to use cash.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is a very encouraging conversation. You're just Melissa, a little Sister Mary Sunshine here.
Melissa, it's about to get worse. So, okay. Mike, you talk a good bit in your book about what the CIA and FBI have become. And for those, I highly recommend that everybody read Big Intel. One of the things that they need to read it for is to see just how woke these two agencies have become. Can you talk about that just a little bit for the audience?
Yeah. So imagine a surveillance state like this in the first place, and the likelihood of abuse, even under the most benign circumstances. Now imagine you have ideologically motivated, and really transcends political parties, this sense of wokeness to destroy everything that's good. And they will enforce this wokeness on you, which you can't go on to ChatGPT and ask questions without having them give you some very subtle critical theory commentary that's put aside on it. So you talk about, some, cultural issue, and they'll say it's important to reconsider the necessity for inclusion, or some stuff that's embedded into the logic. There was somebody from the National Archives who's a whistleblower who came out, and he pointed out to me just this morning that one of Biden's very first executive orders on his first day as president was to compel all AI relating to the government to promote the E in DEI, meaning AI logic. If any of these companies want any business with the U.S. government, they have to put wokeness into the code. So imagine then this becomes weaponized against us offensively, and not simply a matter of collateral damage or mistakes or occasional abuse, but it's designed to be this way. Go through executive order after executive order of Obama and Biden have baked this into the system. And then the training that's going on, or go to the CIA and National Security Agency and FBI recruitment videos and recruitment web pages and X accounts, you'll see that they're with the exception of certain scientists and technicians, they're only trying to recruit woke DEI types to become our future intelligence professionals.
Well, that much is clear, even in the military, and how COVID essentially was used as a screening method to get rid of anyone who had resistance to ridiculous rules. So right. they were baking into the military and government cake conformity, and right. that was the defining characteristic they were looking for. They certainly didn't want intelligent questioning. And so and they're doing that now because the recruitment levels are lower. And so the only people who are wanting to go in to the military, not the only, but they're certainly encouraging that, is people who will submit and agree to kind of inane systems, and will not think for themselves, which is a disaster. I mean, I think the American military, one of its greatest strengths was that the youngest private in certain, ethical or difficult situations had the, moral authority to make a decision and had the mind to do so. And now, from what I've heard from military trainers, that they're having to kind of encourage people to think for themselves, but they're recruiting for people who don't. And I'm guessing that the intelligence agencies are looking for the same. They're looking for absolute conformity. And groupthink.
Yes.
Why though?
Larry, you can't get promoted now in the FBI or the CIA without, when you have your quarterly or your annual, in the military, they call it fitness reports, and some others call it, promotion reports. If you don't check the boxes to that you're not only agreeing with DEI and all this other nonsense, but you're actually believing in it and promoting it as a professional, this goes on to your record. So if you don't conform, you don't get promoted. And it's like in Orwell's 1984, you've got the protagonist Winston Smith. It wasn't enough to him to just say that 2 + 2 = 5. He had to believe that 2 + 2 = 5. That's the way it's literally become in our intelligence community.
Well, along those lines, you talk about in your book, and it didn't surprise me, but it shocked me, that both the FBI and CIA apparently are actively recruiting people with emotional and mental problems because they're along the DEI totem pole. And, you know, I guess because they realize that DEI is the reason that they're there, they're going to conform 100% to its dictates rather than think for themselves. But I don't want psychopaths in the FBI. I think that's a really, really bad idea. I mean, we've seen a few psychopaths in the FBI. At the very beginning of your book, you talk about Peter Strzok, who is clearly a psychopath. And yet, apparently, he's the model for what they're recruiting, or at least if they have to take a white guy, they want it to be Peter Strzok.
Yeah, and then think of the quiet. You got the psychos on the one hand, but think of the quiet side too. If you have DEI as your criteria as a worldview, what does that mean with rules of evidence that are collected and presented to build a case and to present before a judge and jury?
Right.
It means you cook the evidence to conform with what? Equity, right. Which is the outcome.
Yeah, you get a bunch of Lavrenti Berias is what you get.
Yeah, yeah. So they're baking in critical theory, which came from where? It came from Lavrenti Beria's predecessor, Felix Dzerzhinsky, who had the first conference to cook up this stuff 5 years after the Bolshevik Revolution. And then, you know, the United States ends up importing these people from Central Europe as they flee the Nazis. And then they set up shop in our universities and within our own intelligence services and state departments. And we wonder, how did we get here? This is the whole story, the whole genealogy of this.
But I wasn't aware prior to reading Big Intel that Herbert Marcuse was in the OSS.
Yeah. Yeah, I couldn't believe that either. It's like, what? Of course he was.
And you go to the CIA website now and they include Marcuse as one of their own. They don't say, well, here's a counterintelligence thing we should watch for. We have a Stalinist who was under Soviet control who then broke because they didn't like Stalin's cult of personality and his socialism in one country. They were more global communists. So Marcuse then goes into the OSS, not simply to defeat Hitler, but to rebuild the post-World War II world along Soviet vision.
Right.
Not American. While we're fighting, this day doesn't draw any lessons from this.
Right. I mean, it's, you know, it's, I guess they'll put up a statue of Alger Hiss next year in front of the CIA headquarters in Langley. Why not? Right.
Yeah. Well,
it's funny that you said that, because the current CIA director, Bill Burns, kept a portrait of Alger Hiss on his wall when he ran the Carnegie Endowment.
Of course he did. Oh, Jesus.
What doesn't, like, Brennan, who basically ran the operation during Trump's administration to make up the lies about the Russia collusion crap. I mean, he I just assume that he's a communist and that this has been like, and not a very secret one. Is this a problem? Would you say that in the CIA in particular, that it draws this kind of one world government, you know, utopians, this kind of, I mean, if they're into Marcuse and if they're using critical theory, which is all just Marxism and, you know, really Leninism, isn't that just, How would you even know if someone was anti-American? Because this seems so inherently anti-American that if the leadership is this way, what even qualifies as anti-American now?
Well, this was actually, I talked to somebody inside the system recently who's involved with recruitment, and one of the problems that he, as a sort of still a patriotic American, has observed is that the newer people coming into the intelligence community think that anti-Americanism is anti-diversity. They're the same thing.
So America is DEI and DEI is America, which is.
Yeah. If you oppose DEI, you're anti-American and therefore you're a threat. And so
that's of a piece with this narrative that white supremacists are the number one terrorist threat to America. Like, this has gone on since 2009, at least. You know, I mean, like, going back to, for example, the Fort Hood shooting was, to me was sort of an unseen break in like American history. Was, you know, you had a known jihadist who was not hiding who he was. Okay, gave out all of the, I mean, this guy gave off more red flags than a May Day parade. And he shows up and he shoots up the base, kills a whole bunch of people. And immediately after, I can't remember who the guy was, the general running the army says, well, the real tragedy here would be if we lost our diversity as a result.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, shut the whole thing down, right? Like, I mean, you're literally not even protecting your own soldiers in the name of diversity, and you think diversity is worth preserving?
Right.
Like, forget it. Forget this whole project. And yet, it has only metastasized over the last, you know, 15 years since then, into this, you know, thing where the diversity piece is what's important and nothing else is. You mentioned in your book that we don't have to continue with these two agencies. It may be difficult to do something with them, but you do have some solutions for going about this a different way. You want to talk about those for just a little bit?
Sure. And it's sort of to get off the pessimistic side, which is...
Yeah, exactly.
Because
I can see Melissa's getting really depressed over here.
I was already depressed. This is just confirming my priors. So, you know.
Well, actually, the publisher told me directly, you have to have something positive at the end of the book, or else people are just going to go away, just, you know, completely demoralized. And they were right, because when you think of it, this is what the other side wants. They want all Americans to feel demoralized and depressed and isolated and hopeless and just go into their shells and just take whatever's coming at them and accept everything as a given. So we can't ever allow that to happen. So there are real solutions. The first solution being, of course, having a president who's going to come in and do something about it. Now, last time around, Donald Trump literally put the CIA in charge of itself. He is the one who, on Chris Christie's advice, put in Chris Wray as FBI director. Thinking that changing the leadership at the top will do it. Well, no, he has since learned his lesson now. And so from what I understand, he has a team put together to have an action plan to address this, doing just what Clinton and Biden and Obama and Biden have done, is to have executive orders pre-written in advance before even coming in and say, this is going to happen now. We're going to repeal these previous executive orders, put these in place, and just stop a lot of the damage, and then have an actual team with an actual action plan to do something right this time. So I think there's a lot of reason for hope there. And he's certainly motivated enough to do it. Just a question of getting the right team. So the last two chapters in Big Intel are all just to start a national discussion on what this should look like. We need an intelligence service. We need to know what's happening around the world. We need secret intelligence to advise our leadership. And we need a covert action capability to do certain things that must be done and not keep sending troops all over the place. So given that, you don't need a big, bloated, woke bureaucracy. But you can say, and you can't fire everybody. You know, you can't fire people at will or single them out. But you can.
Why not?
Well, the law protects them. Right? So, but there are ways to do it. If you simply abolish the positions and don't create new ones for them to go to, they have to leave government and pull their security clearances. So anybody involved in DEI is gone. You know, you need, there's a lot of bloat. Of all the 38,000 or so CIA personnel, there are only about 1,500 who are actual agents.
Oh, wow.
CIA clandestine officers abroad, rough guesstimate about it. So it's pretty tiny. And a lot of what the CIA does isn't necessary. We don't need to spy on the climate. We don't need secret intelligence on global warming. And we don't need, a gender espionage capabilities, really. So get rid of all of that. But on a lot of the other things, too, where they've been wrong, just abolish those slots and then abolish the individuals that go with it and then start something new. So I would cut down the agency and then divide it into one standing clandestine service that's separate from the intelligence collection and analysis side as a basis. And then it can't get too powerful on you. Second thing is, with the FBI, it's only a bureau. Angelo Codavilla always used to say, it's just a bureau. Don't be in awe of it. Bureau is bureaucracy. So it's the federal bureaucracy of investigation. Get rid of it, but keep the functions we need as separate entities. So put all your criminal, the criminal branch of the FBI to fight crime, send it to the U.S. Marshals, which is not yet woke. It's getting there, but it's pretty, it's relatively scandal free over the years. And it's the only federal law enforcement service created by the founding fathers. So it has legitimacy. So put that there, put FBI training there, or what is right now FBI training, put it with the U.S. Marshals. What other investigators, they don't require firearms. So disarm a lot of the special agents. And when they're going to run investigations in the states and cities, have them do it in concert with the local police, local sheriffs, and so forth. And that will really cut back on the ability of the central apparatus to abuse people. You know, move counterterrorism over to something different that's legitimate counterterrorism. Do a quality control thing. Do an audit. You know, who's been right on this? Or who's been looking at the Boogaloo Boys as the main terror threat to us? And who's been ordering FBI resources diverted from counterterrorism and fighting child trafficking to going after gay Sixers accused of misdemeanors? And there's been a ton of that going on. So you have to audit all these things and then figure out where you're going to break this whole thing up. So break up the FBI into six or eight different pieces and then let the rest wither away and remove them from government service. And the other thing, in places where sheriffs have a lot of authority, in many parts of the country, those are democratically elected law enforcement officials. They have power to tell the FBI to go take a hike. They can't prevent the FBI from working at the local level, but they're the FBI's eyes and ears. They often provide the office space or the other kinds of manpower. And oftentimes they deputize FBI or ATF and other agents to be able to enforce state law, which they could not do. The federal officials cannot enforce state laws, but they can if they're deputized as sheriffs. So we all need to pay attention to the sheriff's races and the places where sheriffs have a lot of this authority. And this year, ask the incumbent sheriffs, how can we support you to remain independent if you are? And then talk to the challengers and say, what will you do to protect us from federal abuse?
Are there opportunities in state law bar cooperation with the FBI, where DEI and some of these other things are part of the action? I mean, is there a way at the state level to make it so that, you know, the FBI is going to find it really hard to operate in Texas if the FBI is a woke, aggressively woke bureaucracy? I mean, I know the Center for Security Policy does a lot of, you know, work at the state legislative level. I mean, are you guys working on anything like that that might rein in the FBI?
That's my colleague, Chris Holton, who writes for the Hayride, as you know. So he's really active on this at the state legislative level. He's done a ton of work on this, as has Kyle Scheidler, who's our Homeland Security and Counterterrorism person. And they have actually a sheriff's training program. And then they're I think Naples, Florida, that county. The county where Naples, Florida is, has declared itself a sanctuary county to not help the FBI if the FBI is believed to be doing something unjustly in the county. So that was a first. And I know there's legislation in Tennessee right now before the legislature, something to that effect. So some of the states are starting to wise up.
Excellent.
And it's true, like in Texas, the sheriffs and the county judges have an immense amount of power. And, you know, it's what saved a lot of places from even state level laws and whatever, because the local guys just said, you know, the local sheriff in the county I was in was like, we're not enforcing any mask laws, period. And so then it became kind of moot. That is actually something that I want to check in with and see how they would respond to, you know, the FBI being involved. Because what a lot of people don't realize, or I certainly didn't, is that there are the Bureau has local state level outposts, essentially, in many states. I know in Texas, there's at least four one down by the border, two, one in Austin, one in Houston, and another one. And Dallas. Pardon?
Dallas.
I don't think it's in Dallas. I thought it was like there were two near the border.
Yeah, but I'm sure there's an FBI special agent in charge in Dallas. Yeah.
Well, there might be, but I'm saying like an actual building where there's a bunch of agents. But, you know, I don't know. That's another thing that I find bothersome, because they're increasing this kind of net at the more local level, and it'd be nice to boot their butts out. And I was just like wondering why, you know, that is happening more, or if you think that's a bad or good thing. Or
there are 56 field offices that the FBI has around the country and in some of our territories, and so those are the main anchor points at the state and regional levels for the Bureau to function, but they still need support of the local authorities to do a lot of their work. The quality of the field office is a different issue. So, you know, it's funny that the special agent in charge of the Detroit field office for all of Michigan was there when the FBI was running that plot against to kidnap Governor Whitmer and then bust all these losers for something they never would have done in the first place. He was then moved to the Washington field office right before January 6th. Mm-hmm. So you've got to wonder, you know, who are these individuals and how do they get promoted? There was an announcement today that there's a new special agent in charge of the Anchorage field office, but to look at her resume, she's not qualified for that job. She only has 6 years investigative experience, but she seems to be a DEI appointee. Some of the field officers are great. And privately, a lot of these FBI people will quietly agree with the types of things we're concerned about. And they say, there's really nothing we can do. To which one responds, you can blow the whistle. But then the FBI has made such an example on those who have blown the whistle. I mean, the FBI won't even fire these guys. They suspend them indefinitely, which means they take away their badge, they take away their gun, they take away their paychecks, they take away their health insurance, and then they won't allow them to get another job because they're still officially FBI agents who have simply been suspended.
Right.
Their lives are being made miserable. So they've been set up as an example, but they haven't broken. They're fighting back, but it has kept a lot of others from coming forward.
There was, I got an email from one field office, FBI director of a field office in the Northeast, and he and his whole team, they were visited after the whole Hillary thing happened, where they weren't going to actually do the investigation, and that was all spiked, and all the work that had been done was just, you know, flushed. And what's his face? Comey, I think it was, came and visited, and was so insulting that he and the whole team quit. And he's like, he was mad at me because I had written a piece about something having to do with the FBI. And he's like, you have no idea how bad it is. Like, you just have no idea just how terrible it is. And I think we all have a really good idea now how terrible it is. What you're describing as far as making sure this local sheriffs, I mean, people are like, okay, what can we do? Well, that is something tangible, but it seems to me that unless this is broken up, unless what you're describing happens, unless Trump is much more competent in his second, should he get elected, second administration to deal with this, it sounds like, you know, basically we're just being, you know, the Americans have lost the rights of being in a free American are gone. It is what it sounds like.
This is our last chance.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, think about it. Now the left is popularizing and normalizing the notion of a second civil war.
Mm-hmm.
Making movies about it.
Obama, yeah. But Obama, by virtue of his connections with Netflix, is personally involved with this, literally in the script writing and the screenplay. So you have this normalization of civil war coming bit by bit by bit. And then this transition integrity project run out of Georgetown University Law School, where you have some of the nation's most influential lawyers in and out of government, retired military generals and think tank types, and you know, gaming out scenarios for them if Trump really literally is democratically elected in a legitimately counted election, how they are considering putting together a government in exile.
Mm-hmm.
This was reported not by any of our friends. It was reported in The Atlantic last week. So they're popularizing this idea. They're trying to normalize the idea that things are going to get worse and we all just better buckle up. It's not a question of us not owning anything anymore and being happy and eating bugs, but it's a question of now normalizing something of our country being torn apart by this central machine that feels threatened.
By the central machine that feels threatened. Okay, Mike, if you could tell everybody the title of your book and where to buy it and where to find you, that would be great.
Great. The title of the book is Big Intel, How the CIA and FBI Went from Cold War Heroes to Deep State Villains. And it's available, first, it's available at Costco. They've carried it so far for more than 2 months. But it's available anywhere else online where you would buy books, plus on Google Play and Apple Books, and then whole lot of other, you know, every other outlet you would think of, although Barnes and Noble, their brick and mortar stores have seemed reluctant to carry it. But the best deals at Costco, and it's still, the audio version is still number one new title on Amazon's espionage and intelligence list. As far as keeping track of what I'm doing, it's at J. Michael Waller on X, and then at the Center for Security Policy, which is securefreedom.org.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for joining us today and for really scaring the ever-living daylights out of me and probably every single person watching this video. So, you know, for all of you who are watching, like and subscribe in case you want to be just, you know, forget watching, you know, some kind of thriller on TV or at the movies, just come to the Spectacle podcast for real life terror and fear. Thank you so much for joining us, Mike, and for being with us. And thank you all for watching today, the Spectacle podcast. We'll see you soon.